So I would start this conversation maybe from your most recent book, Inaudible Invisible, published by Les Presses du Rail. And from the title of this book, as we are recording this conversation, I am in a small studio at home. If I look out of the windows, I see some construction sites, but the sounds can barely arrive in my room because they are filtered by the windows, the same optical devices that allow me to look outside. What I find very interesting, one of the things I find very interesting in your work is this possibility of becoming aware of infrastructures, of what is inaudible and invisible. And I think that your work, both aurally and also visually, often brought to the visitors, to the observers, to the participants of your work, this possibility of becoming aware of what is usually hidden, both visually and also aurally. And so I would start from here because you are trained as a flute player, piano player, and a composer, and then you discovered and made us discover this hidden world of the everyday life.
Yeah, I must say, before I started to study music, I studied 2 years at an art academy painting. And my teacher, an abstract painter, he said, "You will never be a good artist or visual painter." And he was very clear, and I don't know why he recognized this, but at least I had this experience of working visually as well. And from that, then I switched over to music. Of course, I started playing music when I was a child already, but I was always undecided if I wanted to be a musician, a visual artist, or whatever. So I had no clear image of my future. And of course, at the time, there was nothing like media art, or at least we didn't have the knowledge. We didn't have internet. There was no information of the possibilities that would be possible. So I think, yeah, the hidden things have been present from the beginning in my work, but I don't think they're really so hidden. It just depends how you look at them and how you try to discover them.
But I think there is this sort of growing awareness towards what is, let's say, hidden. Maybe it's not really the perfect word to describe it. But I think it goes somehow also hand in hand with this philosophical and ecological approach towards the non-human, so non-human presences, non-human minds. Let's say, I don't know how you relate also to this quite new, actually, cultural approaches to understanding the world, studying the world, trying to deal with the world, which is changing quite fastly.
Well, I think questioning the reality is something every artist does. And of course, it's about the many aspects of reality. I think if I see something in a certain way, it can be quite different if I see it from a different point of view. If I hear something or listen to something, it can be different if I listen from a different angle. And I don't know exactly why I'm so attracted to hidden realities or things which are behind. It is, I would say, almost been like that. Maybe something is in my biography because I was born right after the Second World War. And as a child, we were playing in ruins a lot. We were not allowed to, but of course, we did all kind of strange games. And we were always saying, what was here? What had happened? You know, we were growing up with stories we invented about something which had maybe disappeared, which had been there, and which we tried to reactivate in our minds. But it's, of course, just a little by idea. I think we are surrounded today by so many different realities that it is important to question them and to say, no, I'm looking at you at a video screen, but of course I don't know anything about your real place and what is happening around you. So I could take this as granted, but it's just that, I don't know. I think it's important that we discover the many different aspects of what is around us in order not to judge things as black and white or good and bad, but to get a better idea of, well, I mean, the fantastic variety of things which are around us as well, and many things you have to discover.
I think that this also appears clear in how important is participating in your works, making decisions, improvising somehow also while meeting your sculptural works or your electrical works, because the participants have to move in space, choose what they want to explore, but also again thinking about the contemporary world, there are many of your works that are deeply involved and making us discover interesting things. I chose one for a question, which is Cloud, this ongoing project, because I think it is a very interesting notion, that of the cloud. There are many books and articles because it is an important metaphor. I'm thinking, for example, about the things James Bridle wrote about that. But I would like to ask you how this project was born and how it is evolving. It brings many different presences in the same space, which can be explored. This cloud can be explored both, it has both a physical and visual presence, and also can be discovered through its sounds, obviously.
Yes, Cloud, I'm always surprised that the request for an installation of Cloud is still there. I mean, it's more than 10 years ago I started this work, and it is based on two things. One is that the word cloud normally means nature. It means a certain freedom. It means, it has a certain significance, which today it doesn't have anymore, because mostly talking about cloud, we think about computer clouds. We think about storing and archiving digital data. And this kind of diversity between the word and what is behind, two realities again, always has interested me. I made a work, I think, in 1996, which is called Mouseware. And Mouseware is as well a work where are real mouse and computer mouses and recordings of people working at the time with a real mouse, and the sounds sounded almost like animal sounds. So I started before with other works, this kind of theme, and it goes on questioning why the digital industry uses always these things, these words, which are not really connected to what is technically behind. I think they want to give us an idea of freedom, that everything happens just in the air without any further reality. Maybe it's easy, it's light, and this is not the truth. And the truth is that all the computer clouds need a lot of industry behind, like all the farmers, server farms, and so on. And so my cloud is a real cloud, which is heavy. It's not light. It's almost, it's made of 1,500, 1,600 meters of cable, copper cable, and it weighs about 100 kilos. And it's real, but it deals with the idea of the computer cloud. And so I went to different server places, not so many, because it's very hard to get in there, and made recordings of places with a lot of, with all the hardware behind, which gets us the communication even now between us. And these places, which are hidden mostly, they are often in countries where electricity is cheap, where the standards for protection, ecological protection, is not so high. So it's interesting that behind the lightness of a cloud of the idea is a very heavy place, and it's very noisy. And I was in Poland last year in a really big place for farming, for computer farms. And it was incredible because all the circulation of air, it has to be cold in there. And I don't know how you say in English exactly, the cooling down was so, so strong. It made such a lot of noise that I almost wanted to go out immediately. So these places are dirty places in a way. They are not clean places. And when you go along the cloud, you hear these dirty sounds, not the acoustic sounds, but the electromagnetic sounds which happen in these places, as much as I could get. I'm sure there will be much more. And people can go around. It's like between 12 and 14, sometimes 16 channels. And so when they move from cable to cable, they hear a different sound through small special headphones, which have a copper coil, and the sound is just transmitted by electromagnetic induction. It's a simple analog system. And maybe that's one thing why it people accept it or do it, all kind of people. It's immediate. It means you put on a headphone and you don't have to understand anything technically. You just work with your ear. You just work by listening. And for me, it's very nice. Sorry, I talked so long about it, but it's a good question. it's so nice to look at the people because they are like performers. And they're all different. Some people are very slow listening, every small detail, and some are going beyond the cloud, or they run around. Sometimes people even lay under the cloud on the floor, and they take different times. And so I can see the way a person is listening by the movement, by the appearance, by the kind of, approaching the cloud. It was a long answer.
No, it's fine. It's nice to listen to you. And since you mentioned nature and somehow the inspiration you had also from nature about this this cloud, I was thinking about the definition of art, which has a very long history, comes from very far, but also John Cage used this definition, which is an imitation of nature in its manner of operating. And I was thinking that you often related to natural environments and or both in a very clear way and also metaphorically. So the sea, the garden, nature is part of your work in many installations, also starting from the very titles of your work. So I would like to ask you what you think about this, which is your relation to nature, and also your idea of nature also in relation to your artistic production.
Well, I was growing up in an environment which was quite natural, with gardens and so on. And nature for me is something of the most important inspiration I have. I can't live without nature. My work is taking place in big cities, but from time to time, regularly, I have to go out and I have to be in nature, I have to listen to nature. The question is, again, what is nature today? There can be the kind of nature which is parks or which is just domesticated nature. Sometimes I travel to Africa or other places where I have a different experience of nature, which is endangered, of course. And that's much more intense and gives us the idea that there are so many aspects of nature. What we call nature is not something, it's not one thing. But We depend on nature and we are part of nature. We are natural beings. And if we forget that, and we forget that more and more by all the kind of other communication, by in natural communication, I would say, that this relating back to nature, for me, is questioning the people as well. I mean, there is some older works like The Conference of the Trees or The Bird Tree, where people listen to strange sounds through electrical cable. And often they said that work is from 87, and they said, oh, this is nice electronic sounds. And I said, no, this is bird sounds. What? Is it possible? And so it means very often when they listen to sounds which are natural, they have no experience of these sounds. And so they just can't relate to them with a personal idea or memory. And they just think it's something. It's made artificially. And as we can create so many artificial things today, the question is really important. What is still nature? I mean, how can we relate to nature, and how can we know something is natural?
And since you mentioned also the bird songs and bird sounds, I would like to move to another recent published work of yours, which is PLUS. There are some tracks that are built starting from collections. One is a collection of your of vases, for example, and another is a collection of imitations of bird chants. And so I would like to ask you about this relation of your work with these collections, because if we want, we could also consider nature as a sort of repository or archive of all the possible orders of all the possible things that can happen in this world. So a collection is a precise definition maybe of some elements of nature. And so I would like to ask you how these pieces were born. I'm thinking about especially Vase and Resonance and Tea Time.
Yeah. Well, I'm as you might have noticed, I'm a hunter and chase. I like to collect things, sounds, images, and so on. But it's not for making money with it or having something precious. It's more personal interest. And the collection of vases actually started because I thought the vases of the 50s, I collected vases of the 50s, which were not expensive at all in the beginning, and you could find them at every flea market. They were so beautiful. They had all these kind of abstract paintings of strange forms. They look like Paul Klee or Dubuffet or André Masson, what I don't know. And so it was just really, I just liked them because they were beautiful and I could arrange my flowers in them. And then I found out they make interesting noise. I use them sometimes like instruments, just by fun, to blow into them or rub them or so on. And then I started to become a little bit more precise, and I got a big, big book, a kind of book about the vases of the 50s. And it's a kind of Bible with all information you can get. And there I found this kind of list. There's several lists in it, but one list is the decor names. And the decor names of that time were all the names of places which were at that time places of desire, exotic places, places people wanted to go, like Lebanon, Damascus, and so on. And when I read them, I said, oh, this is all the places today where horrible things are going on, wars and fights, and the world has changed so much since then. And so I thought the list of these names were interesting, and that's why the lady in the piece, Vase and Resonance, she is reading parts of this list, just the names of what was the places for the fantasy in the 50s, you know. And the other sounds were like using them sometimes, like places where I put in hydrophones, my vases. I was allowed as well to visit a factory in Germany, and Scheurich is the name, and they were so nice. It's one of the last factories where they still work with hands partly, And we had 3 days, me and my assistant Ekiguta, to make recordings. They just left it around in the factory. And so many of the sounds are factory sounds of still of making vases. And all this came together. But the important thing is maybe the text or the words which are connected to, yeah, to the reality of the 50s when, you know, things were, in, at least in Germany, there was a big boom for, yeah, for money, for better living, and what is the situation today? So, yeah, that was one of the reasons. As for the bird sounds, I think it's just funny that people try to imitate birds with words. And I often like this kind of parallel things which have different meanings. It was something which sometimes they get an idea like that and then it rests for a while and then suddenly there's a possibility to do it.
And you also have a collection of disappearing electromagnetic sounds. So I would like to ask you something about that, because I'm interested in the fact that you are trying to develop strategies to keep this collection alive and available also
This is not only a collection. I mean, I started the electrical works in 2003, and I started them because the works I did before with electromagnetic induction became more and more difficult because there were so many sounds around which I captured in my installations, but which I had not created. And this, of course, were all the electromagnetic fields which were increasing. And since then, I'm every year recording and making electrical works. The last one was number 93, and it's in many, many places of the world now. And whenever I go and prepare these walks, and even if I don't make a walk, I go with my special tools, my electromagnetic recording headphone, and I listen to the parallel world of what is the acoustic world. And very often it's very much connected. If you're in big cities like New York, you have an incredible lot of electromagnetic, loud, deep sounds. If you're in Finland, it's more moderate. And in Italy, you have a lot of very interesting, surprising sounds. I remember my last electrical walk in Rome. It's something which, in a way, is like a mirror of what you normally see and hear. But the sounds have changed a lot. And I don't keep them as not in the sense of having a collection, but I just keep them because I think I'm the only one recording them at the moment and having them. And it's so much, I mean, it's really huge amount of sounds which are all in my computer. They are archived in the year, the city, I have notes. And when I compare the ones from, let's say, 2004 to now, almost 20 years ago, the quality of the sounds is very different. The first sounds were more, the electromagnetic sounds, which were transposed to acoustic sounds, were warmer, more rhythmic, more beautiful, you could even say, and based more on analog techniques. Now, nowadays we have G5, we have an incredible lot of routers and senders and antennas, and these sounds are sharper, they are higher, they are narrow. You don't hear them everywhere sometimes, but then when you are in the field, it's very, very intense, sometimes even piercing. And some sounds like beautiful neon light sounds, I don't find them anymore. And there's other things, certain train sounds and so on. And it's like with everything. I mean, all the working places change, fashion changes, a lot of things changes, and we don't even notice so much. But the velocity of the changement of electromagnetic fields is really, for me, surprising. It's so quick.
I am thankful that these sounds can be explored in a recently relatively new website dedicated to the electrical works. And it's very interesting, I think, not only for artists, but also for people involved in urban studies, for example, or on social matters, to explore this huge archive of sounds. And I would like to ask you something about this website, because it contains a lot of information in the form of sounds, text, and images and maps. It is information which is very helpful to study also in different layers, in different ways this works. So I wanted to ask you which decisions also you had to take in order to organize so many different kinds of information in a single website which is accessible to many users.
Yeah, thank you. This website was really kind of present, I must say, because I was invited to the Ultima Festival in Norway, and the director at that time, Torbjörn is his name, he proposed to create a website where all these sounds could be presented besides the electrical walks, which are always limited to a certain time and number of people who can experience it. It's not huge because the real material I have is so much more. And we thought what is important. One thing is at the beginning to describe the sounds, maybe to give people the possibilities to listen them. And then there was this idea of having these 3D presentations. And we did it in Oslo and then last year in Georgia, in Tiflis, in Tbilisi. And this means that the people actively, as in the walks, can go around and access sounds and look at different places. And I would love to go on. We are trying now to get to a third place on an island to continue. But the big problem is I'm an artist working a lot, and I don't have, as a sound artist, not a huge stuff around me. I can't even pay for that. And the website was paid by the government, the Norwegian government or whatever, I mean, the cultural institution for 5 years. And I hope it can go on. But all the other work I do for the website is my personal decision, or it's friends who help me. And I would like to do much more. And that's a problem with an archive. You need a place where you can give it. You need a place where people can continue to work on it, maybe put a certain order in it or something. And sometimes I think I'm just exploding with all the material I have, and I would like to give it away, but there has to be a way. So maybe if you have an idea, please help me. But on the other hand, I must say it's very good to have restrictions, because the people from the website said we need that it is easy to access, we need this and that, and they gave me some precise ideas. And I hope after Christmas I have 2 weeks to add more things. It's really something which on the one hand, there's always the reality of having an abstract idea. You could do a wonderful website and put in information. On the other hand, there's the reality of your personal living. I want to have at least some private life as well. And I'm working so much, and I have to find the time and the energy to do both. You know that. I think every artist who's working a lot and loving the work has the same kind of dilemma, of problem and excitement at the same time.
Yes, I can understand. Then one reason why I find the website so interesting is also how it relates listening to the maps, because we are witnessing many sound maps dedicated to different cities. But in most cases, they are a collection of field recordings with a localization that can take ideally the user to a specific place. in a specific moment. But the soundbox are something different because they allow the listener to somehow feeling as participating to a sort of movement within the city. So it is a different way of activating the map itself, I think. And we are also witnessing growing interest toward the practice of sound walking. Elena Biserna, who is also the author of a text in your recent book, recently curated some books and also a collection of scores for sound walks. And I would like to ask you, how do you see this growing interest towards sound walks, and what you think could also be the future of sound walks if they are going to keep growing, what challenges also they can take people to face in the exploration of this ever-changing and fastly changing world?
Well, I think sound walks are a way of discovering the world by active participation. That's something really important because you don't just look at an artwork, you don't sit in a theater or in a concert hall, or you're not in a museum. You're somewhere, very often places you have not seen before, or places you see with different eyes. And you discover something which you have not heard or seen before. And that this is possible is due to a different kind of art we have today. Because I don't think that sound walks would have been possible in the amount we have them today, and that even people can live from it or, you know, have them always as a profession in the 70s. Of course, there were people like Willem de Ridder and other people who made already experimental sound walks with cassette recorders, with stories you could have around and listen to, but it was just very rare. And giving us today the possibility of in a festival, for example, very often there are sound walks, there's exhibitions of sound walks, there's this wonderful book of Elena about sound walks. Having it as something almost official makes us clear too that the kind of art we have around today, the acoustic art, the visual art, has changed. And I love to be in a classical concert, sit down and just listen. But I love as well go around in a strange place and discover something by someone who leads me through an app or a personal approach or something. And I'm very grateful that we have this possibility today. And I hope it's going on. I hope there will be many more sound box, maybe even with different technologies, because it's something people want. People like it.
Yes, maybe we really need to be taken outside of doors, or also to experience spaces in a different way. It's quite a radical shift from what the early modernity brought us, somehow with the perspective and arts and music more and more confined to specific places. So it is also a way, I think, of eliminating the boundaries between what is only artistic and what is only ecological or pertaining to the everyday life. And I don't know what you think about this. I remember a definition of sound art given by Alan Licht in his book about sound art. He focused on the difference between a possible definition of music and a possible definition of sound art. So music speaks to us as human being, while sound art somehow involve us and speak to us as animals, as dwellers of a planet which is not only inhabited by human. This is not exactly the definition he gave, but somehow it is the way I remember it.
Yeah, well, I think even the what is a sound installation, for example? Today, almost everybody calls everything a sound installation. You put a video into speakers, they call it a sound installation. But originally, I mean, the kind of pure idea of a sound installation is really a place where you can listen to sounds, and the sounds can be musical in the classical sense even. But it means too that you can have different times. You can come in and out when you want. You can walk in and out as you want. You can have different positions. You can come close to a sound. You can. It means, again, movement. And this often was not accepted by the modern classical new music scene, because they said there's too much chance in it, it's not really clear, and we want to have everything very precise. Actually, I stopped my flute playing because I was sick of playing every day or studying every day, so many hours of playing very difficult music which sounded just like improvised music. And I think that this saying, okay, it's very interesting to say one is for the human and one is more like different worlds or the animal world or whatever, but I don't see it so much separated. I mean, a good sound installation is like a concept for me, just with different ways of behavior. And coming from traditional music, for me, it's very difficult to do something like just say, oh, okay, the sound is not so important, or it just goes the way it goes. I'm very precise where I put sounds and the levels and how they're composed together. So I still work in my sound installation from the idea of a classical trained composer, but I'm sometimes envious because other artists who make sound installations do not come from music. They come from architecture. They come from visual arts, and they do something different because they don't have these boundaries. Because having studied classical music too is a kind of burden. It's wonderful, but too it obliges you to think in a certain way. And I can't even now. I can't get completely rid of that. So I would say a good sound installation always is close to a good composition, and I would not divide it as much between music and other things.
Thank you. I would like to ask you about your drawings, because I have these beautiful books of yours, which is electrical drawings, and there are different kinds of visual works of yours, and some, for example, are sorts of scores or representation of sonic presences or of your sonic works. So I'm curious to ask you about this relation between the visual representation and drawings of yours and your sonic work.
Well, I told you, when I finished school, I studied visual arts for 2 years. And that was what I thought I would do all my life. I love to draw, because drawing is more than painting, even a very personal thing. Even now, when I am just working on a new piece for the radio, German radio, it's called Weaving. And I do it. I'm always drawing at the same time in some books and relating. I can translate things very well, but only working on a computer or writing down scores, but just by using my hand as a kind of making visually what I have in my mind. And so drawing for me is something very natural. Of course, sometimes it has to be more precise, and then it's a little bit more difficult, and I have to, from the beginning where I scribble down things, I have really to think how to organize things. But it's such a good direct way to do things, and it's not many people say today, oh, you could do it on the computer, even draw, but that's different. I love the paper. I love the noise of drawing, and I think it's something. We're so much afraid today of direct things which happen without the translation of a computer. And drawing is one of these things which is out of your body and then it's there. And I would say I just need it for my work.
So it also plays an important role in your creative process, let's say, if I understand correctly.
And most of it is not published. I mean, all the kind of my drawing books, and I have many, many, many. It's full of drawings, and but it's just my personal books.
Would be very interesting to see them, but I understand that drawing can be also just like writing, also very personal. So
but
I was curious about your dialogue with Bernhard Leitner for the work you produced site specific for the Weimar Castle. So you had to consider a specific relation to memory, to the heritage of the site. And so I would like to ask how you related with that specific site and for your installation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, many of my installations are site specific, and this is quite an important question because many installations can be done only once. Of course, something like the cloud can be transported and done in different ways, but very often I work in places which have lost their history, like this castle near Weimar. Ettersburg is the name. And it was a very famous place where famous artists had worked. Then during the war, it had been something where the soldiers had been living. Afterwards, it had been a hospital, and it had changed all the time. And I'm so much attracted by places like that. There's not so many now, but there were much more in the last two decades. To find out something about the history of these places and what the history tells us. So I try to find places. I sometimes use UV light as well to look at hidden traces. And the work in Weimar was very nice. We were invited by Nike Wagner, who was at that time curating the festival. And we had the whole castle. I mean, this castle today is a hotel, they told me. It's a wellness center. And the place where there was a little theater of the 18th century today is the toilets. So, I mean, it doesn't exist anymore that way. It has been destroyed in a way, or it has been changed. And I like this kind of situation when places still have their memory, but something new has not yet arrived to change them completely. And this is, again, like, yeah, thinking about different realities, like showing people, look at this place and think about your own memory, what can happen. It was fantastic to work there. We had so much freedom. We didn't have any limitations. And so having a whole castle with a lot of time and even the possibility of making a book afterwards is something for an artist, which of course is not only inviting, but you try to do your best. You try to give all your energy. The other thing is that I admire Bernhard Leitner a lot. He's a very good friend. I just visited him now near Vienna, where he has constructed a new kind of studio where he makes all his research. It's huge. It's wonderful. And we often meet. We often discuss. And at that time, a kind of dialogue started between us about what is music, what isn't music. He always says he's not a composer, but he is for me. And I think these kind of artistical dialogues are very important. I must say, when I started my artistic work at the beginning of the 70s, we had, and I mentioned that before, we had no internet, we had no computers, we had no Google or whatever, and we just were communicating in a personal way, which was very difficult sometimes, and sometimes it was very intense. When we wanted to have a certain record, sometimes we traveled to a place 200 kilometers just to get it. You know, we had to connect, we had to exchange, we had to create things on a personal contact. And this for me was always important. It still is important. A lot of my relationships today are just like that. And I I don't have any kind of Facebook or contacts. I don't like it. It's not interesting to me. So people say, "Oh, you're so old-fashioned." Okay, what's bad about that? It's just my way of having communication in a way which gives something back, and which means it's not always easy. With Bernhard Leitner, I was often fighting about ideas, and with other people, I fight too. And I was 30 years, almost 30 years, a professor for sound art. And I was fighting a lot with my students really hard, because I think only when they have someone they can, they have to try to get their own mind and to see if someone has a different meaning, what do I really think about that? What I do want? That's a way of getting further, you know? And so it's, I'm still known that I like to discuss, that I'm sometimes difficult. I don't think so, but still, I often say what I think. And I don't mind if this is very polite or not. So maybe I think I could be a little bit more polite sometimes. But that's, I think this way of communicating is important, because today everything is so much politically diverse. You have to be cautious, you have to be correct, and whatever. And I think sometimes we are like, yeah, we don't, we are not allowed anymore really to talk and say what we think. This has started now by mentioning Bernhard Meitner, and it has gone very far. But yeah, that's my comment about it.
But I think it's part of a dialogue. I mean, we cannot always agree on anything, and giving our ideas is part of a dialogue and of a discussion, which contributes to an artistic or whatever else kind of dialogue. And you also have other artistic dialogues going on that are particularly relevant for you with other artists, composers, musicians. I'm asking because I have in mind the double CDs you share with Anne Lockwood, which is titled The Secret Life of the Inaudible. So you had this thing in common, which is represented by the title, and you explored in different ways and exchanged
Well, I know
what.
Anja from my first days in New York in the 70s, and she was very friendly. I don't know exactly where I met her, but it was easy to meet people at the time. And she presented me other women composers. And I think what was important for me was to discover that there were women composing, because I didn't know so much about that before. I mean, how should we know? We were surrounded by men, and yeah, a woman was considered to be an instrumentalist. A flutist had to look nice and play good, and she was not considered to be a composer. And discovering this kind of different world in New York for me was very important. And the talks with Anea, who had a maybe a similar background in a way, were very important. And since then, we are in contact all the time. I just met her 2 years ago in New York, and I'm always impressed by that. I'm always impressed by her energy and her ideas. And though she has not such an easy life now, because her wife died and she's living alone, and she is still, you know, she has so many ideas and is going on. She's so curious, at least, and she wants to know about the hidden life of sounds which are considered to, well, I don't know, the sun, the wind, or whatever. That's not so much my interest. But when we said we would like to make a collaboration, it was about this research about hidden things. Yes.
Somehow, I recently have read again Quantum Listening by Pauline Oliveros, and especially in the last part of the book, I thought a lot about your own work and Anne Lockwood's work, because of this idea of expanding listening, of listening to listening, which is something I relate to something James Turrell often says, which is that he wants to us to see ourselves seeing, and somehow listening is even more, because it is something that can expand this possible field of listening. And yes, it made me think of your own work and of Ania's work for this possibility of expanding the possibilities of human listening. I don't know if it makes sense to you or not.
Yeah, Pauline was one of the other people in the 70s who, she introduced me to many people, and she was so generous, and I met her several times. She was often in Berlin, and she even tried my headphones, my electromagnetic headphones, and she said, oh yes, maybe we could do this and that. You already started to invent new possibilities of using them, you know. Yeah, she was one of the these other generous people sharing, trying to communicate. And maybe this is something which is common to all of us. We try to share things, we try to network, we try to have common experiences, and not just to be the great composer who makes the piece for 100 players in a big orchestra, and you have to stay there and clap, you know. It's different. And I miss Anil, I miss Pauline a lot, because I mean, it was, even if we didn't meet so often, it was always so inspiring as well to see her. I think maybe this is a generation of people. I'm a little bit younger. I'm like, let's say, 15 years younger than this first generation of women composers. But they have helped me a lot, and they have helped me with being conscious that a woman could become a composer, could do something which is different from traditional composing. And I'm so happy I could meet them. I think today it's different. You can have all the informations you want, but maybe as it is so many informations, it's almost like having no information sometimes, because at that time it I must say again, I'm not nostalgic, I don't want to live back in that period. But you could be a feminist in the hardest way in the 70s, you could really be against things, and you knew what you wanted, and not, you could discover things. And all this, besides meeting these wonderful women, had a big influence on me, and as well meeting John Cage, I must say, because I met him several times, first in Bremen at the Pro Musica Nova Festival. And then he invited me to, when I was in New York, to meet him, and I was in Stony Point. And he was not famous at that time. That was middle of the 70s, 76, 78, I think, two or three times. And he was not even considered a serious composer. And it was just so inspiring to be with him, not talk about music, but talk about mushrooms and nature and whatever. And I think that was another thing which helped me, just because he was such a great person. I was not aware he would become such an icon in the modern musical history, because at the time he was not considered to be one. But I knew he was important, and his way of looking and listening was important. And yeah, so in a way, talking about my background, these years in New York were quite important to me, because it was different from the European context, which was very straight and didn't give us so many possibilities as young people to expand our knowledge and our experience.
So do you think that the fact that we are overwhelmed by communication also impacts the way artistic communities can be built? I mean, for community, I mean also the exchange of ideas, of feeling and being part of something which is happening. Do you think that things are changing?
No, not really. I mean, this is we all need this kind of exchange, and maybe just the ways of exchange are different and are a little bit more open or more varied. I don't know, but I think in general, it's just what I would say is just for a young artist it's much more difficult to choose the way he wants to go because he has so many different ways he can go. And sometimes when you have too many offers and not enough background, then you get lost. And then maybe sometimes it's good you have a person like I had at that time who helps you, who talks to you, who maybe is even someone who makes hard discussions with you. And this, of course, today can be professors at art schools, music schools, conservatories. It can be artists in general. But I just would say that it has become easier on one side because we have all the communication information, and it has become difficult at the same side because we have all these informations. It's double-sided, you know?
Thank you so much.